You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, John Everard and Brett Mason will join us to discuss, among other things, the North Korean missile test and the frustrating search for missing flight MH370.
The objects were located approximately 2,557 kilometers from Perth.
Then we find out why the Portuguese are considering finding extra income by selling their valuable collection of paintings by the Catalan artist Joan Miró.
This collection would be more profitable if it's shown and if it's well managed, because the revenues coming out from exhibitions will be paid by itself.
We'll also get recommendations on what to watch on Canadian TV. Get ready for the Larry King of Canada and a crime series that topped the ratings straight away on its first season.
Smell it.
I don't want it. Cordite?
They've been using cordite bullets since World War II.
Well, that's all I need is a killer and a time machine.
All that, plus a check-in with our man in Madrid and music too. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. A satellite has spotted what's being called potential debris in the southern Indian Ocean during the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines aeroplane. The 122 objects measure between 1 metre and 23 metres in length and were seen about 1,500 miles off the coast of Perth in Western Australia. They were captured in satellite images from the French company Airbus, taken on Sunday, March the 23rd. It's not yet known if they're connected with flight MH370, which disappeared more than 2 weeks ago on its way from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Perth is preparing for the possible arrival of hundreds of grieving family members as the search for their loved ones continues. The city's Chinese Community Association, Chunghwa, is also trying to arrange the kinds of services the relatives will need. Two-thirds of the 239 people on board MH370 were Chinese. Chunghwa President Jimmy Yap says they can offer some comfort.
Without knowing what their needs are and without having been in such a situation before, we're not 100% sure what we can do for them. But I would imagine the biggest one is providing emotional support. We speak their language, we understand their needs, their culture. So this place here, the hall that we are in at the moment, we can offer them, open it to them as a place they can come to rest.
Osama bin Laden's son-in-law, Suleiman Abu Ghaith, has been found guilty of plotting to kill Americans by a New York court. The 48-year-old was al-Qaeda's spokesman and principal messenger in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks and now faces life in jail after a three-week trial. The Kuwaiti clergyman testified that he agreed to bin Laden's request to speak on videos to inspire new recruits for suicide missions. As well as conspiracy to kill, Abu Ghaith was also convicted of providing support for terrorists. He's the most senior al-Qaeda figure to go on trial in the USA and will be sentenced on September the 8th. Mr. Abu Ghaith's lawyer, Stanley Cohen, says they intend to appeal.
We believe that there was sufficient error in the course of this case. We're confident that on appeal, an appellate court will look very differently at some significant issues that occurred both before the trial and during the course of the trial. And my client is confident that at the end of the day, we will be back. It may not be for 6 months or a year or two, but we'll be back.
The United States and the European Union are discussing further sanctions against Russia if there are more incursions into Ukraine. U.S. President Barack Obama says energy is a central focus of their efforts and acknowledged it will have some impact on the global economy. He was speaking after talks in Brussels with EU leaders José Manuel Barroso and Herman Van Rompuy. The bodies of two more people killed in a massive mudslide in the U.S. state of Washington have been recovered, bringing the total to 16. Authorities say they think they've found eight more bodies under the mud, but they're unable to retrieve them. As many as 176 people remain unaccounted for. A 54-metre wall of mud buried the town of Oso, north of Seattle, on Saturday. Officials say the search will resume at first light. The family of a Chinese activist who died in police detention this month have been denied access to her body. The human rights group Amnesty International says a Beijing hospital have told Zhao Shunhil's brother and lawyer her body is no longer being held there. Amnesty says the hospital has refused to disclose her medical records. Ms. Zhao's family say she was refused medical treatment in custody, but China says her rights were protected. A court in Turkey has ordered the suspension of a controversial ban on the social media site Twitter, but it could be weeks before it takes effect. Turkish Twitter users had hoped to regain access shortly after the ruling, but the site remains blocked. The country's telecommunication authority has 30 days to decide whether or not to lift the ban. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed to wipe out Twitter after users spread allegations of corruption. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's currently 18:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And we'll be right back after this.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here is now 18:07 in London, which means it's 14:07 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, and Brett Mason, Europe correspondent for SBS World News Australia. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start with what seems like a case of looking for a needle in a haystack, except for the needle may be moving tens of kilometres every day. A further 122 objects that could be from the missing Malaysia Airlines plane have been identified by a satellite. The objects were found in images from a 400 square kilometre area, some 2,500 kilometres from Perth. Australia's Defence Minister has described the search as a massive logistical exercise in a remote part of the world, which has extremely strong winds. Brett, let's start with you first of all, and let's not get in too much depth about the debris, as it were. But first of all, for Australia, what does this mean? You know, for Malaysia, it has been a PR disaster from the word go that has now kind of damaged the nation's brand in many ways. But for Abbott and Australia, it seems a good display of openness, coordination, openness to other countries, organisation. Do you think this is actually a good moment for Australia and oddly for Abbott to seem, a good statesman on the world stage a little bit?
Well, it is to an extent, but some serious questions are being asked in Australia about how this passenger jet could travel so close to our borders and apparently not be spotted by the intelligence services. So there have been a lot of questions in the last 48 hours about why we didn't see this plane, for all intents and purposes, heading towards our borders. So he's faced some tough questions about that. But certainly he's been on every news channel around the world talking about the search, still hasn't been able to provide the closure those families have been looking for. Whether Australia can is yet to be seen. I think that the search area was described as being looking for a needle in a haystack, only you don't even know where the haystack is, and that's a pretty fair explanation. And I think that the reality is that we probably may not ever know what happened to that plane, or in fact where it rests. This is one of the most remote places on Earth, and it might be closest to Australia, but it's still a long way from anywhere, really.
And we're running out of time. The batteries on the beacons on the plane have got maybe 2 weeks of life left in them. If we don't find the plane in that time, we'll be searching not just for a needle in a haystack, if we can find the haystack, but for a very dark needle in a rather black-coloured haystack.
And John, just pick up on this idea again of what it means for the images of the nations involved, because China has been doing a lot of harumphing, but actually hasn't been that successful in spotting anything itself. The Malaysians have certainly been disastrous, and the problem is with the airline being state-owned, there's a kind of a whiff of secrecy about everything that happens. Many of the countries in the region, it's felt, could have done more much quicker by releasing information and have been slow to do it. What do you think it says about the various governments around this area and how they've behaved?
I think one of the things that most interests me is the reaction of the Chinese. A lot of rumpfing, as you rightly say, they thoroughly enjoy beating up on the Malaysians. But one of the most interesting aspects of the Chinese reaction is what they didn't say. When it was possible that the plane had actually gone north along the northern corridor through China, they did not come out and say, no, no, that is impossible. We would have seen it. It's not just Australia that doesn't have a fully functioning and fully effective radar interception system. For the other government, I think the problem is that emotions inevitably run very, very high in these circumstances. And I think that the expectations of what governments are going to do were, in many cases, quite unrealistic. By and large, now the dust has settled, I think you have to admit that the government of the region actually did okay in terms of providing the hardware and the information when they could. It would have been better, of course, to have more information sooner, but it takes time to process satellite data, and it takes time to resolve those images. My impression is that people came forward with information as quickly as they could.
But there's also a much larger question here, and that is, why on earth don't aircrafts have the same ability as vessels, and that is to ping live data from the aircraft about where they are on Earth, how fast they're travelling, for about $1 an hour. Any airline, I believe, can do that using satellite technology. As someone who spends much of his life on a plane, I find it staggering that a big airline like this could simply disappear and no one know for weeks where it is. So there's a lot of people are asking, well, okay, that's fine. These governments may be doing all they can now, but should more be done in the first place to ensure that we know where these planes are in any eventuality if these transponders and other devices are switched off? Can we use readily available, cheap technology to ensure that if something like this happens again, we can get there quickly? The most terrifying part of this story for me is if there were survivors in the ocean waiting for help to arrive, and it obviously never did. It's quite a traumatic thing to even contemplate.
I think you're absolutely right, Brett. I think that a lot of questions are going to be asked after this terrible incident, and that probably quite inexpensive measures could be taken to make aircraft a great deal easier to track.
They could do it tomorrow. They could do it today.
Well, I guess that we don't know what, obviously, Brett, you're touching on there, this idea that, and I think that's for many Chinese people, that seems to be the thing that's most upsetting, is the narrative has changed every day, that people don't know what happened to their relatives. But it does seem, although terrorism was raised at first, it may be something very mundane, that that maybe there was a kind of a massive decompression of the plane and these people could have been knocked out for seconds. It could just have been flying on its own.
I think that is very, very unlikely. I think that the facts that have since emerged show pretty clearly this was a deliberate act. Somebody wanted to ditch that plane for reasons we may never find out in the southern Indian Ocean. Cutting out your communications just at the point of intersection between the two flight commands, flying at an altitude designed to minimise radar contact, and flying a trajectory that would take you right to the most remote places on Earth. No, that was deliberate.
Just before we move on, you touched a little bit on the criticisms that are circling in the Australian media. Abbott wasn't exactly doing very well in the poll ratings before all this happened. Do you think that for him, you touched on it a little bit, but for, at home or abroad, what's the gain for him? Because, he's potentially better relationships with China if he's seen to be helping them. Do you think at home he may see a little rise in his popularity?
Look, to be honest with you, I don't think it will have any impact at all. I think that Australia has found itself in this rather odd position where we're not directly connected to the operation, other than the fact that we happen to be closest to where this plane looks to have crashed. I don't think so. I think it's certainly a chance for him to display his credentials on the world stage, for him to express sympathy and, as you say, act like a statesman. But I think most Australians, I don't think it will have much of an impact in their, estimation or belief of him being a good prime minister or a worthy leader or anything along those lines.
Well, let's move on. Let's move to North Korea, which has test fired two mid-range missiles just hours after the US, South Korea and Japan met in the Netherlands for talks. This was the first time that North Korea has fired this type of missile since 2009. Obviously, I'll come to you first, John. Are we surprised? And oddly, does it matter? We're so used to this kind of behaviour from North Korea. Does it matter this time?
Yes, it does matter. It matters because although we've become kind of numb to North Korea, what a Freudian slip, firing off short-range missiles. They've fired off around 80 in the past few months into the sea. You know, people just almost shrug at that now. Developing long-range ballistic missiles is another matter entirely. That is part of their plan to be able to deliver nuclear warheads to Japan, China, Russia, eventually possibly to the United States. This does matter. And this, I'm sure, will draw the attention of the Security Council. It matters particularly now because the North Koreans are reacting not just against the United States-South Korean military exercises that are continuing, but also, almost certainly, against the absolute bombshell that the president of China, Xi Jinping, dropped just 2 days ago, meeting with President Park Yong-hee of South Korea in The Hague, where everybody gathered. He said in public that China favors Korean reunification, provided it is peaceful and independent. Now, those are code words. The South Koreans have always asked for peaceful unification. The North Koreans keep talking about independent unification. So Xi Jinping, in one very neat formulation, saying, firstly, we do not oppose unification, which means effectively a southern takeover of the North. Everybody understands that, and the North Korea is a wreck. And two, that we would envisage this reunification having elements both from the South and from the North. This will have sent shivers down spines in Pyongyang. China is signaling it is prepared to cut North Korea loose. And if it does that, it's game over, and the North Koreans know that. Other bits and pieces, if I may.
Yeah.
Over the past few days, the North Koreans in New York have indicated they are preparing a fourth nuclear test. If they are stupid enough to go ahead with that, and I think they might be, then China is going to suffer a huge sense of humor failure. It has warned North Korea again and again and again to start behaving or else, and North Korea simply ignores it. North Korea has hung up a big slogan in its principal military academy saying that China is a traitor and is our enemy. Not the kind of thing that goes down really well in Beijing. Moreover, there's been a leak that at the time that North Korea officially was cuddling up to the South, do you remember all the rapprochement and the warm fuzziness early this year? Kim Jong-un issued an instruction to his generals to prepare for invasion of the South within 3 years. And the catchphrase was, Kim Jong-un said, I want to ride into Seoul on a tank. It doesn't exactly encourage you to believe that this whole thing is going to end quietly.
When you look at this, do you see the work of a madman, a fantasist, or do you think that this is somebody we should be genuinely scared of? It seems unlikely that he's going to ride into Seoul on the back of a tank. That seems to be a dream. But
firstly, he would need to find a working tank and a tank with petrol in it. Not easy in North Korea.
Just tell me how you see the situation.
Well, I'm intrigued by the game plan because what's the motivation behind all of this? What's this guy hoping to achieve? Is it to assert his authority? I tend to think it's more a domestic audience that he's catering to. He knows that the West doesn't take him seriously. We take him serious enough, but no more than we absolutely have to, let's be frank about it. But alienating China, alienating what few allies this country has, just seems to me to be really risky. So I don't understand the logic behind it. I mean, I know we're talking about a country that isn't renowned for its international diplomacy and logic when it comes to these things, but why ramp it up now? Why do this? And I tend to think that, the correspondents that I know that have been there and have covered it, saving face is a big thing. He wants to assert his authority and his pride is probably being dented by what's being said about him in the West, in the media, on the internet. We know that he watches a lot of cable television. He has access to the types of things that most North Koreans could never dream of. So he knows what's being said. And I tend to think we're seeing a young man who's trying to impress the world with his bravado, but the reality is whether they push those limits, I can't see it. But maybe you're across this more than
just tell me quickly if China does pull support, what impact does that have?
Korea collapses. North Korea collapses. It's as simple as that. China can bring North Korea to its knees in 48 hours if it wants to, and if China, it doesn't need to pull completely. It can simply start to implement the United Nations sanctions to which it signed up in with greater force. That would damage North Korea. Can we remember today is the fourth anniversary of the sinking of the Jeonnam, of the South Korean corvette. That, another significant date, that will probably have played into the North Korean decision to launch those missiles.
So why risk it? That's what I don't understand. I can't grasp. Why would you risk losing all of that if you're the dear leader? Why on earth would you push that friendship?
Standard North Korean practice. If you are threatened, you counter-threaten, and you escalate and escalate and escalate. You count on the other guy blinking first, and this time I don't think they will.
Well, this is a story that we will definitely be returning to. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, John Everard and Brett Mason. When we return, we'll discuss President Obama's headache with Russia and North Korean hairstyles, potentially.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Brett Mason and John Everard. US President Barack Obama is visiting Europe and has been in Brussels today. On the list of discussion topics were more sanctions against Russia if there are any further incursions into Ukraine. Barack Obama has also announced that the US will stand by its European allies in the face of Russian aggression. But at the same time, he rules out using force to dislodge Moscow's forces from the Crimean Peninsula. Brett, let's come to you first. Do you think that the US has any idea how to handle Putin?
None whatsoever. I spent a couple of weeks in Crimea during the height of this crisis, and my impression from on being there on the ground is that we saw another massive overreach by the US. We saw it with Syria, John Kerry's speech that for all intents and purposes appeared to be, you know, a prologue to war. And of course, we saw the president wind that back in. Now with Crimea, with Ukraine, we see again John Kerry speaking tough, but really knowing that there was no way the EU was going to back the types of sanctions that he had hoped for, because Germany, the powerhouse in the EU, 40% of its energy comes from Russia, so much at stake there. So really, it was quite an interesting diplomatic dance that was being executed across the region as Barack Obama and John Kerry tried desperately to get support that never really came. The sanctions quite weak, really, only impacting on a few people.
Simple question there, Brett. What can be done?
Well, that's without flying the flag for war or intervention. The only thing that was possibly going to stop what happened in Crimea was some type of military assistance in the lead-up. Everyone knew in Kiev when we were covering the uprising, everyone knew there was no way on earth that Putin was going to allow Crimea to be torn away from him. Everyone knew that build-up was happening. How the US, UK, others say that they didn't know, that they were taken by surprise, is frankly, beyond a joke. They must have known what was going on in Crimea, and they allowed it to happen. And then to jump up and down and beat their chests after those Russian troops moved in shows a level of unwillingness to intervene. And I'm not saying that they should have. I'm not taking an opinion on that. All I'm pointing out is that everyone knew that was going to happen and no one was willing to intervene until it was too late. All this talk of sanctions, they kicked in when every building, every airport, every military installation in Crimea was, if not already under Russian control, was about to be. Those sanctions came far too late and everyone there knew that. And there was a sense from the Ukrainians in Crimea that they'd been cut loose. The ones who wanted to remain in Ukraine felt as though that was allowed to happen because there was an unwillingness to step in and fight that fight, which they believe could only be done physically, not through sanctions or punishments. It's not going to hurt Russia at all, I don't believe.
We knew from the outset that what was happening. You're quite right. I mean, I don't know why people sort of protested otherwise. But we decided also right at the beginning that we were not going to use force. That decision was not made public. But it was taken at the
It had
very
to
simple.
Have been.
But let's be honest, we can't really use force.
I guess we could, but there's a deep reluctance to do so, not least because that is precisely what Putin wanted. Heroes, he wanted martyrs, and he wanted heroic Russian soldiers to get killed, which would boost his popularity no end.
But there's no...
We weren't going to give him that. Instead, firstly, we impose sanctions, token sanctions. I mean, what have we got, 22 people on that list? I mean, it doesn't matter what you put in. A bit of paper saying sanctions is all you needed at that stage. And the timing of the sanctions didn't matter. They weren't going to stop Putin taking Crimea wherever you played them. Point one, this means that Russia is being treated like a tin pot African dictatorship. You do not sanction great superpowers, you sanction the bad boys, and Russia is now standing in the corner with a dentist hat on its head. Two, the sanctions that would really bite, the economic sanctions, were not brought in because they were held in reserve to prevent Putin taking any more of Ukraine. And one of the great achievements, I mean, I think you downplayed a bit what Obama, Kerry and the Europeans managed to achieve, but one of the great achievements was that the Europeans agreed they would implement economic sanctions if he goes for eastern Ukraine.
And that was late in occurring, and I think that's the big concern that everyone had conceded, that the Crimea, for all intents, is gone. It's whether he's prepared to move into some of those other regions, as you say.
I don't think it is late in occurring. I think he hasn't moved in, and the threat of sanctions, the warning of sanctions, is there. Notice the effect. We haven't even sneezed yet. We haven't imposed these sanctions. Already, the ruble has crumbled 20%. He's lost $60 billion. We're seeing massive capital outflows. He's had tens of thousands of people demonstrating in Moscow.
So are we saying actually sanctions are effective?
I'm saying that sanctions are extremely effective. And I'm saying also that although in the short term, Putin has grabbed Crimea and he appears to hold the cards, in the long term, we hold all the cards. And Putin knows that.
Right. Are you going to jump in?
Yeah. Along the east, though, there are still a lot of communities where there are violent protests every night calling for Russian intervention, calling for liberation to return to Mother Russia. And I'm not convinced. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I don't think they've been as effective. I think that they're an effective means by which to halt that progression. But those troops are still on the border. It's still incredibly tense. And all it takes is for one young Ukrainian soldier to fire a shot or vice versa. I don't think that they've been as effective. There is no question whatsoever that the US, the EU and others could have done a lot more. They could have hit Putin a lot harder than what they did.
If we had gone in big at the beginning...
I'm going to have to stop you in a second. Well, you have one point, George, on.
Okay, if we'd gone in big at the beginning, you hold nothing in reserve.
Yeah,
yes, of course things are tense. Putin's got to make sure that they're kept tense. That's the way he wants it. He wants to be able to trade away an invasion of eastern Ukraine, which he may not even be planning, against some kind of relaxation. We're not going to give him that, but let him play his game for the time being. The point is that in a short term, we can actually sort of switch off.
You've got to get haircuts
in. Okay, haircuts, come on.
No, I'm just going to my two pence worth, because the only thing about sanctions is, let's look where they've been used. They've been used against Zimbabwe. They've been used against North Korea. They've been used against Iran. They're all still in power. They may be impoverished, but they're also... No, John, we're going to have haircuts
all right.
now.
Haircuts then.
Just because you've got a rather short haircut. We've got 2 minutes to go. We're going back to North Korea. Now, is this a fantasy story? There's some ridiculous story floating around that all North Koreans are now going to have haircuts like their dear leader. Is this true, or is this just a bit of kind of PR?
I think it's a bit of a fuzz. I think the background to this is that when we had the dear previous leader, Kim Jong-il, he used to go around this amazing bouffant hairstyle. And some North Korean men took the wrong lead from this and thought that it was okay for them to have their hair coiffed and permed in the Kim Jong-il style. And a circular went around saying, no, guys, no, you're men. Only the leader does bouffant. You have short back and sides. It's now come around, of course, to Kim Jong-un, who has a more, shall we say, conservative hairstyle. And the people are worried in case they get slapped on the wrist again for copying the leader's hairstyle. So the circle go out saying, this one's all right, guys. You can copy this one. This one's safe.
I'm a big fan. I'm wearing the Abbott, and I see you're wearing the Cameron. I think we're carrying them off well.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for that. And hairdressing tips. We didn't get to talk about Venezuela, where there has been the arrest of three leading military figures who have been accused of a coup plot, but that will have to wait for another day. John Everard and Brett Mason, thank you very much for joining us here. At Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, I think I'm going to need my referee's whistle tomorrow. There's plenty to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to hear about the Portuguese debate on what the country should do with its collection of valuable paintings. We'll check in with our man in Madrid and we'll get recommendations on the best of Canadian TV. Yes, there is some. But before all that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest world news.
Satellite has spotted what's being called potential debris in the southern Indian Ocean during the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane. 122 objects measure between 1 metre and 23 metres in length and were seen about 1,500 miles off the coast of Perth in Western Australia. It's not yet known if they're connected with flight MH370, which disappeared more than 2 weeks ago on its way from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Osama bin Laden's son-in-law, Sulaiman Abu Ghaith, has been found guilty of plotting to kill Americans by a New York court. The 48-year-old was al-Qaeda's spokesman and principal messenger in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks and now faces life in jail after a three-week trial. The United States and European Union are discussing further sanctions against Russia if there are more incursions into Ukraine. US President Barack Obama says energy is a central focus of their efforts, and he acknowledged it will have some impact on the global economy. The bodies of two more people killed in a massive mudslide in the US state of Washington have been recovered, bringing the total to 16. Authorities say they think they've found eight more bodies under the mud, but they're unable to retrieve them. As many as 176 people remain unaccounted for, buried under at the town of Oso, north of Seattle. The family of a Chinese activist who died in police detention this month have been denied access to her body. The human rights group Amnesty International says a Beijing hospital have told Zhao Shunli's brother and lawyer her body is no longer being held there. Amnesty says the hospital has refused to disclose her medical records. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Bill. Well, welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Madrid to speak with our correspondent there, Liam Aldous. Liam, thank you for coming on the show. I don't hear any kind of clattering or banging behind you, but it has been a long weekend of demonstrations and some of the recriminations are beginning now.
Yeah, it's been actually called one of the most violent demonstrations since the start of the Spanish crisis began. And it was actually a pretty peaceful protest from the beginning all day. It was called the March for Dignity. So, I mean, you'd want them to be behaving well if they're marching for dignity. And basically, it was a very peaceful day. There were concerts. There was up to a million people on the streets. The police say it was only about 100,000. You never know who's right. But at about 8:30, it turned ugly, and some people from the extreme left, as the police called them, started throwing rocks and fireworks at the police. And what happened was quite an ugly scene, because the police, even though there was about 1,700 riot police on the streets, they were quite heavily spread out, so they were underprepared, and there was actually 70 police officers severely injured.
And tell me, it's all got a little bit complicated. I understand that there's been claims that the it was Spain's answer to Golden Dawn. That's what the regional premier has said. But what does he mean by that?
Well, yeah, the rhetoric has actually been quite disappointing, and this has actually overshadowed the events themselves. And the lead up to the Dignity March, a lot of these people that converged on Madrid actually came from all around Spain. They walked from places like Barcelona, Galicia, Andalusia, so it's a pretty long Dignity March. But they actually tried to do blockades of banks and symbolic gestures like this. And Madrid's regional premier actually called them Spain's answer to Golden Dawn, saying that they were just extremists, but they just answered back saying the right-wing government is actually closer to Golden Dawn than they were. So the war of words began before they even got to the city. And then after the protest, the police did this extraordinary thing where they came out on TV and showed these photos of a crutch or a pair of crutches that had been converted into big knives and said they'd been confiscated at the protest. And it later emerged that these photos that were flashed on TV to try and incriminate the protest movement were actually confiscated from a separate incident at a court 2 days before the protest. And it's worrying that this was confiscated at a court in itself. But the fact that the police would go on TV and show these images without really checking them up to begin with is really worrying. And they've come out apologising, saying there was a lack of due process and they didn't really check up on it. But the fact that they're showing these pictures is quite worrying, because the war of words just has continued throughout the week.
Liam, you know, this tit for tat from both sides, you know, pointing fingers, you know, obviously something bad did happen. But more importantly, where does it leave Spain now?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think what's being shown this week is that everyone is quite willing to argue, but no one's willing to try and work towards solutions. Everyone's name calling, everyone's it's quite tense. There's actually talk, national talk, about a big new law, the citizen safety law, as it's being called, to try and incriminate or criminalise, is a better word, for certain actions at protests and even the protesters themselves. So for sure, the government will try and use what happened on Saturday to reinforce their argument, and it's actually just going to up the ante. And I think the protests from now on will continue to be violent, because violence just begets violence.
Now, it seems that when people come to potentially see you in Madrid, they'll no longer be landing at Barajas Airport.
No, they've actually got a bit longer mouthful to pronounce. It's now going to be called the Adolfo Suárez Madrid Barajas Airport, which is a bit of a breath. But it's being named after the former Prime Minister, Adolfo Suárez, who actually died on Sunday. And he was a treasured leader, because he was the leader who transitioned Spain after Franco's death to democracy, and was a leader who really worked towards consensus and bringing people together, which is a stark contrast to the political leaders we have today. And it was quite a positive affair, his funeral, if I can say that, because a lot of the past leaders were brought together, and it's a very rare image to see former prime ministers come standing next to each other. And they were actually standing together, and the cameras were rolling, and you could hear their small talk, and they were asking each other about their nieces and their sons and daughters. And that became a new story in itself, because it's not an image that Spaniards are used to.
And once again, it obviously hints at a country that's kind of pulling in different directions. And one of those is potentially, once again, for independence for Catalonia. This is a story we've touched on with you again and again. But what's the latest development here?
Yeah, it's the story that never ends, and it's just building up to a bit more momentum this year, because Artur Mas, the regional premier, is very stalwart with his plans to hold a referendum, even if it's deemed illegal. He's not going to call it a referendum, but it's going to take place in November. He's already set the date, and there's a lot of clamouring from both sides, from the Madrid government and the Barcelona regional government, or the Catalonia regional government, sorry. But the recent development is that the High Court, Spain's High Court, has overturned Catalonia's declaration last year, the parliamentary declaration of sovereignty. And it was kind of a strange thing that this case proceeded, because the declaration they made in Parliament was a non-binding declaration. So the fact that it actually had to be taken to the High Court on behalf of the federal government is interesting in itself. But because of this verdict, the Catalonian government has come out and said that the High Court bench is basically completely biased, and they're basing this on the fact that the head of the High Court, it was actually revealed last year that he was a paying member, a donating member to the PP Conservative Party, which basically makes him extremely biased.
So if this vote does go ahead, and if the people of Catalonia do kind of vote for autonomy, what does that mean for Spain, do you think? Does it just provoke the more anguish and more trouble for the country?
Definitely, it definitely does. And the worrying consequence of this entire process is the fact that neither side seems willing to negotiate, and they just keep upping the ante on both sides. And at the social level, it's causing a little bit of conflict. I wouldn't say a lot of conflict, but I go to Barcelona regularly and I talk to friends, and some of them are pro-independent, some of them are not. But just the fact that they're choosing not to continue or see certain friends because they get into arguments all the time is kind of worrying. And the government is just continuing with its agenda. Basically, if they hold this vote and Rajoy basically reacts badly against it, this will just reinforce their case and may actually cause more people to go to favour independence, because it will reinforce the image that Madrid is denying them their rights, and the typical mantra that they always repeat when they criticise how Madrid treats Barcelona.
Well, thank you very much, Liam. That was, of course, Liam Aldus, Monocle's man in Madrid. And you're with Midori House. Up next, we'll hear why the Portuguese are considering selling off some of their cultural assets. There's a plan to sell a very valuable collection of paintings by Joan Miró. But is this a step too far? Stay tuned. You're listening to Madrid House. The Portuguese Parliament has today discussed what to do with a collection of 85 paintings by the Catalan artist Joan Miró. The paintings ended up in the hands of Portugal in 2008 when the government... The paintings ended up in the hands of Portugal in 2008 when the government took control of the BPN bank that was crippled by debt. Now, to get a bit of financial relief, the state is going to auction the paintings at Christie's in London in June. This is something that is a step too far for many, and the decision has sparked a heated discussion about what the country should do with its cultural assets. Monocle's Marcus Hippie met the founder of a public campaign to keep all of the Miros in Portugal. Gallery owner and art curator Carlos Cabral Nunes explained why he thinks it's important for a state to keep hold of the art that it owns.
Because it's a great loss, not just for Portugal, but also for the European heritage. I mean, this is a bit like the Buddhas, Taliban's destroyed. This is a major collection that if it's going to be sold, it will never be gathered together again. So this is a great loss. In the other hand, for us as the citizens of Portugal, we'll never have the chance to see these artworks as they were never shown to us. And we are paying the debt. So it's, as you imagine, a great, great loss.
At the same time, this collection of 85 paintings has been in Portugal for years already, and this bank that used to own them before didn't show them to the public. Neither has the government done it. How much of value is a collection of art if the people living in a country won't be able to see them?
There's two dimensions. One is a cultural dimension. It doesn't really matter if they are shown or not. If they belong to the people, nevertheless, they will someday be shown if they still remains in the country. The second dimension show us is the market value for the collection. This collection would be more profitable if it's shown and if it's well managed, because the revenues coming out from exhibitions will be, and I demonstrate this in a study I did, in 4 years they will be paid by itself by doing just exhibitions. And so it's, as you see, quite a big mistake selling these artworks.
So what should be done with this collection of Miró's painting instead?
Well, they should be preserved, first of all. They should be shown in different places in our country. And then they should be touring, first of all, in our former Portuguese colonies, like Mozambique, Angola, Cape Verde, Brazil. They never have this opportunity of having these works. So this type of Miró works. Just to give you an example, currently in Brazil, in São Paulo, there is a big exhibition with serigraphs of Miró that is being a huge success. Can you imagine with original art? Works. What's the success that will be?
It sounds to me that you connect over here Miró's painting collection and kind of Portuguese national heritage and identity. And at the same time, we should remember that Miró was actually a Catalonian artist.
Doesn't really matter. Almost every museum in the world, their masterpieces are not from local artists. I mean, if you go to Louvre, if you go to whatever, MoMA, if you go to Tate Modern, for instance, you see the bigger pieces, they are not from local artists. Well, you have local artists as well, very important, but I mean, a big museum should have bigger collections, globally speaking, right? That can show the public other artists with such a name as Miró. Miró is one of the most important artists from the 20th century. And we must realize as well that he was a freedom fighter. He fought against the regime of Franco. And if you allow me to say this, I think there is also a political issue on this, because you see, many of the people that are trying to sell these artworks, they are not probably the more, freedom of speech type of people. So this is a bit of the reason why they are trying to sell it.
Many countries around the world have been forced to think about what to do with their national assets as a consequence of the financial crisis. And you've actually mentioned one North American city as a positive example of what to do if you happen to own art, and we're talking about Detroit.
Yes. And Detroit is a very fine example, because Detroit was bankrupt. I mean, Portugal isn't, so this is a big difference. And even though Detroit was not allowed to sell their collections, the general prosecutor in America didn't allow them to sell this. And Christie's, because Christie's has a responsibility as well on this, Christie's played a very important role in the case of Detroit, and is playing a very bad role, as I'm able to say, about the Portuguese case. Because in Detroit, what they did was suggesting alternatives to the sale and giving the Detroit representatives ideas in how to raise funds and money from their collections without selling it. And in Portugal, they didn't do that. And, I must say that I'm a bit disappointed, because it's the second time I'm trying to have a meeting with them to explain them that this is not a political issue, this is not something against an auction house, this is something just to protect artworks that belong to the population of in Portugal. And trying also to make them see that if they go on with the auction in June, they will probably end up not being able again to sell the artworks, and they will do a really profound harm to our country's image, because it will be the second time the works wouldn't be sold out. And this is something that they must realize, and there will be probably consequences, because it's something that they are doing knowing that in fact they are still going on to legal actions to stop this auction.
When you look at this debate, and when you look at what's been going on, say in Greece, that has also had a similar discussion on what to do with the national assets, what do you think this all teaches us?
Two major things. One is the citizens still have some power. And if we raise our voice, this started with me in the 3rd of January. After 1 month, we had 10,000 signatures in the petition, and the politicians came in. And now I'm here giving interviews. So it means that if we do things in a proper way, we can manage to change things. This is something that which I found very good in our democratic system. The other thing, it's not as good as this, it's we are facing a huge problem within our societies in the democratic countries, because our governments, they run the countries for 4 years, 8 years, something like that, and they are just running the countries for the election, the next election period. And they are not thinking in the countries as something that will overcome their own existence. You see, as I saw, for instance, I just came from Dubai and the Emirates. They had a vision 40 years ago. Obviously, they have another problem which the democratic countries don't have. It's they have like a ruler. And I don't want to have a ruler, an ongoing ruler. But we must rethink the way our democratics are being done by politicians in order to have a more efficient government within our countries.
And the Portuguese parliament has discussed this issue of what to do with these Miras paintings. How do you think this all will end?
What I hope is that they are not going to be sold and they are going to be exhibited. This is what I hope.
Well, that was the gallery owner and curator, Carlos Cabral Lunch, who is campaigning for Portugal to keep its Miro collection. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, where it's time now for a little bit of music. Before we review the latest programmes on Canadian TV, believe me, it's worthwhile, music from Toronto. This is Ali X with Prime. Well, that was a bit of Toronto Prime. It was Ali X. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now it's time for our weekly television review. And today we're turning to Canada. And Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Nelly Gacheva joins us with her recommendations of the best and most exciting on Canadian television. Is there such a thing as most exciting on Canadian television, Nelly?
Of course there is.
Before you start, I think we're going to... I'll tell you how we're going to do this. We're going to play the clips of these shows because...
Oh, we're going to start with the clips,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, well, because one of them's a bit suggestive and I want an explanation of what's going on here. We're going to start with a show. It's just called Motive. Here's the first one.
Smell it.
I don't want it. Cordite?
They've used cordite bullets since World War II.
Well, that's all I need is a killer and a time machine.
Well, she was killed with a bullet that was fired from a Webley revolver.
It's the same kind of gun that you reported stolen.
She rejected me?
So you shot her?
He did not kill that girl.
Then why did he confess to murder?
Well, that was some deep breathing at the beginning there, Nelly. Now, this is a crime series. Tell us about it.
So, very intense, as we just heard. It's one of my favorite crime series, actually.
I'm not surprised.
It is shot and set in Vancouver. It's called Motive. And the interesting part here is that it always starts backward. So they reveal the victim and the murderer at the beginning of each episode and then retrospectively show the viewer what's led to the homicide and the entire investigation, of course. So the suspense comes from the motive, as the name of the show suggested.
And who's kind of who's doing the tracking down of the killer? Is it a policeman?
Yes, it's like the regulars. So there is a woman and a man, police officers who are the regular recurring characters, and they're working on a separate homicide each episode. And of course, they always find the killer.
Okay, marks out of 10.
How many marks out of 10?
Eight. Okay, that's okay. I warn you, we're going to rate all of these by the end of it. Next, this is Orphan Black.
An illegal human cloning trial. There's 9 of you.
No. There's only one of me.
Nobody lays hands on me. You don't own us.
You are now pitted between two psychopaths.
I want my life back.
This is all the result of your heavy-handed tactics.
I've only just begun.
She wants everything, Sarah. No more games.
What are you going to do? Just start shooting people?
Yeah.
Okay, it's about clones. It's shot in Toronto, but it's got kind of some BBC America's cash in it as well, hasn't it?
It is. It's actually a original BBC America's production. It is indeed set and shot in Toronto, but they're a huge hit in the US as well. The second season is currently on. It is a sci-fi TV series about clones, as we said. So not my cup of tea per se, but it's Tatiana Maslany who plays the main character. She just got a Golden Globe nomination this year for Best Performance in a TV Series. And also, Orphan Black took home quite a lot of the Canadian Screen Awards earlier this March. Because I know you're going to ask me, it was for Best Female Lead and Director.
The other thing I was going to ask you is how many points out of 10?
Let's say 5.
Oh, she doesn't like the clones.
Yeah, I don't like the clones. That's the thing. I don't like the clones.
Okay. I was going to introduce this next gentleman, but perhaps you'd just like to say his name because I know you like saying it.
George Strombolopoulos.
That's very good. And it's George Strombolopoulos tonight. He's the kind of Larry King of Canada. Let's have a hear of him. He's doing his business.
What's harder to talk about, sex or religion?
Boy, that's a tough one, isn't it?
That's a good question.
So what are you asking me?
You got me there.
This psychoanalysis is going to be a little more demanding than I thought.
We can talk about this for hours, but I'll have to be laying like this instead.
Oh my God, I hate watching myself. Because you walk on and you think, oh shit, it's me again. And you think, maybe just once it'll be Robert De Niro, you know?
What's the longest you've outstared a dog?
Oh, like 3 hours.
I would love that 3-hour primetime special where you're just like...
Well, that was George Strombolopoulos, also known as Strombo. How about
Strombo.
That?
Strombo.
That's quite a good name, isn't it? Now, the big deal is, you know, he's got a massive kind of following. He's done this for 10 series, but he's stopping. Mm-hmm. Why?
So, that's the thing. So, his talk show, it's in its 10th season right now. It airs every weeknight of on CBC. As we said, he's kind of Larry King of Canada, just much younger, maybe a bit cooler. But it was just announced a couple of weeks ago only that this will be the last season as Strombo moves to hosting Hockey Night Canada.
Only in Canada.
Only in Canada. It is a massive deal, actually.
Okay, no, we haven't got long left, so you've got to give him a mark out of 10.
He gets my 10.
Yeah, he deserves 10 just for the name.
We love Strombo. And also it's his 10th season, so yeah, 10th last season, 10 points. We love him.
And Nelly, I'm giving you 10 out of 10 as well. How about that? So there we go.
Thank you.
That was Nelly Kacheva, who's Monocle's woman in Toronto. She's our bureau chief there. Thank you very much for joining us. And well, that's all we have on today's Midori House. Today's show was produced rather expertly, I think 10 out of 10, by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sarah Fournier. They can have 10 out of 10 as well. And even our studio manager can have 10 out of 10. That was Chris Chilvers. Next, after the headlines, is The Entrepreneurs, where we'll be finding out about the lack of online retail in Lebanon. And Matt Barry, founder of Freelancer.com, tells us why outsourcing is the future.
Small businesses and individuals are going to have like this little personal area network around us where I might have a researcher on demand, I might have a designer on demand, I might have a programmer on demand. And that's just the way things I think will be in the future, and it's going to be fantastic. We're going to be a lot more empowered as ourselves being an entrepreneur.
He talks even quicker than me because at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Andrew Mueller. This show will be back tomorrow at the same time, but for now, just time to say goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.